Opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the management of Louisville.am and Veritas New Media, a Louisville.am production.
You're walking along the street, or you're at a party, or else you're alone, and then you suddenly dig. You're looking in someone's eyes, and you suddenly realize this could be the start of something big.
Well, here we are, and we're ready for a brand new edition of Danny O'Day's Louisville Arts and Entertainment on the Fringe. And I've had quite a number of interesting guests in the past few weeks, or actually since August when we started this. And we have a very special gentleman with me at this time. He has been in the Louisville music and entertainment area for quite some time, with Homefront and a number of other things he does. So let's start it off with John Gage.
Hey, Dan.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Now, you've been around, like I said, for a long time, and I know you primarily sing and perform sort of a what kind of music would you say?
I would call it folk.
Yes, music. I was going to say that.
And I avoided that, of course, in the 60s and 70s because it was the kiss of death, you know, if you were a folk. Well, not so much in the 60s, but in the 70s and 80s especially, folk singer was not the label you wanted. No one was buying that, you know. I think we've returned to it a little bit. Now people call it roots music, and that covers a multitude of sins, you know, including folk music and maybe old Delta blues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. All those are roots music now.
Now, where are you originally from?
I grew up in Oklahoma. I was born in Oklahoma City, lived there, went to undergraduate school at Oklahoma Baptist University, 1963 to 67, and then jumped on Interstate 40, heading east, and drove until I got to Nashville, spent the night, and then got up the next day and drove into Louisville. And I was enrolled at the Baptist Seminary here.
Sort of like a gentleman we just had a few episodes back, Ken Pyle.
My compadre.
Right.
He's my man.
Right. He started out there also, I think.
He's a Houston boy. Came up the same way. He's a little bit older than me, so he was there before me. And we are brothers. In fact, I heard of Ken Pyle because he was a former seminarian when I got there who not only drank beer, which was verboten, but he also owned a tavern. So I had to get to meet him as quickly as possible.
So now your roots in music come from Oklahoma, then?
That's correct. The most impressive music for me then was all the Hanks. Hank Williams, the senior, the original, Hank Thompson, Hank Snow, and also Bob Wills, the Texas Playboys. That was, to this day, that's music that is rapturous for me. Although I don't perform much. Yeah, I do a couple of Bob Wills songs, but a little bit of Hank Williams.
Now, you came to Louisville, what year was this?
67.
Okay. And
I was in the windowed womb of the seminary. You could see the world, but you weren't in it.
Ken might have mentioned something like that, too.
It was amazing.
You could see the world, but exactly what do you mean by that?
Well, I was on that campus most of the time, and that little spot over there on Lexington Road and then down to Grinstead and on over to Frankfort, that little area was about it. That was where I was, and I lived in the dorm on campus, married dorm. I was married, then I got married in 67 and came straight to Louisville. And you were sort of, it was almost like mom and dad. We had these little efficiency apartments, and it was $50 a month, including the phone. and they paid all the utilities. So you didn't really have that. If you could come up with $50 a month, everything was cool. And long distance calls were extra, but and you know, all your needs were sort of taken care of by seminary. So it was probably good for me at that time, but I was already struggling with some of the very tight parameters, theological parameters of Southern Baptist. And my intent was to become a Baptist minister.
Right.
Or at least a minister, which is a long story, but that's really basically what I still am, a minister.
That's what I mean. Right. You're ministering.
But I call it a maverick ministry because I don't represent any particular faith group or denomination, and I'm not much of a joiner of religious institutions, but I do participate there, and I'm not on any kind of crusade against organized religion. It just didn't really work for me, and when I came out of seminary, I said, I don't want to be a minister. I don't want anybody to call me that. I don't want to be that. I was an angry young man. I was 25 years old and really mad for many different reasons. Most of it, dogma and orthodoxy of Southern Baptist, which to this day is still something I kind of rail against. And you find orthodoxy everywhere.
Oh, sure.
You find musical orthodoxy. You find literary orthodoxy. You find political orthodoxy. We got people that follow ideological lines regardless of the impact of their thinking. You know, they just stay on that ideology, ignoring all reality.
That's the real definition of the word ignorance, to ignore. Right.
Yeah. That's a refusal to be open.
So you left before getting your...
That's right. I was in my final semester. I was actually in line, and I only had like 5 hours to complete. And I had already been... The whole time I was at the seminary, in their eyes, I was very radical. I really wasn't, but in their eyes, I was. I was always an outlaw there. I got really tired of it because I knew I wasn't anything I proposed. I was against the Vietnam War, and I set up when the chaplains came to recruit us as chaplains, when Fort Knox came to recruit us, they set up their booth in the hallway, and just down the hallway, I set up an anti-war booth, and that made them really mad. Many things made them angry about me, but it really wasn't a radical thing in my view.
Now, you came out of there in 1967, so did you just start?
I came out in 1970.
1970.
I was there 3 years.
Okay.
I completed about 95 hours of study. And I got everything out of it that I wanted. I got a great education, in spite of the fact that it was little bit too far to the right for me. There were some very well-educated. Some of my professors were Harvard graduates, Yale graduates, Heidelberg, and they were very good. They were scholarly people. So I got a lot from it. It's like taking 3 years of your life and immersing yourself in theology, biblical study, pastoral care, just caring for people. And I studied under people like Wayne Oates, who is renowned. He was a pioneer in the whole field of pastoral care. And he was a mentor for me. It's great.
So you left in 1970.
Correct.
And did you, what was your goal then?
Well, I had a pastorate, a little American Baptist Church over in outside Pekin, Indiana. And I was there from March of 98 until June of 1970. In 1970, And that was a wonderful experience, too. In fact, the deacons in my church were like surrogate aunts and uncles. So, you know, they kind of cared for me as a young man and overlooked and forgave a lot of my flaws and blemishes along the way. Good people. And I started working in June of 1970 at the neighborhood house in Portland area of Louisville. So I kind of came into a secular, it was still a ministry, caring for young people, and I came into that, which I call a secular form of ministry, and I did that for 3 years. And then I continued the social work motif by working for, I was director of a halfway house for delinquent boys. It was a residential facility in the old YMCA building at 3rd and Broadway, which we took these delinquent boys fresh out of these horrendous camps that they kept them incarcerated in throughout the state. We took them from those camps, put them on the corner of 3rd and Broadway, which was not a good idea. There was a lot of opportunity to go astray, and they frequently did. It was a real challenge. Following that, I worked for a year at the old Roosevelt Elementary as a family service worker. And so when there were at-risk families, I was on the intervention detail. You know, children that that were consistently truant or showing up a lot with lice and stuff like that. That's I rolled out and dealt with those situations.
So all this was leading up to Homefront, I guess.
Well, actually, in 1974, I had already been playing music a lot, and I really was studying guitar and trying to learn. I've always been a singer, but guitar was something that added on. And I helped form a band called Country Folk, because it was a blending of folk and country music. And I had two other fellow musicians, Roger Coulter and Bill Clark. And we toured around regionally. We played all up and down the river from Paducah all the way up to Maysville and everything in between, Owensboro and, of course, Louisville. We did extensive touring of Bardstown Road. And then we also went up 75 through Ohio, played along there, up into Michigan, played in Ann Arbor, East Lansing, did a gig over in Furniture City. What city is that? I forget. That's what they called it on the CB radios on the western part of Michigan. And then on down through Indiana, you know, Illinois, Chicago, playing music for about 3 or 4 years with those guys. And I got tired of it, really. They're still good friends. I love them. They're brothers. We had a lot of crazy nights on the road, you know. Did everything that musicians do. Mostly out of control. Or at least I was.
Right. Were you married at that time? Or?
I was, and I had a couple of kids, and that was part of the problem, you know. But it was a wonderful thing. But on the road, it's wonderful when you're on stage. That's about 3 or 4 hours. The rest of the time, you get up in the morning, everybody that you played for is working. And I would get lonely. I would get the blues because I miss my kids and their life, you know, and I just got tired of it. Plus, it was living in poverty. My wife had a job by that time as a nurse, so we were able to pay the bills. And I helped out a little bit with the music. Toward the end of that, I started substitute teaching. I also noticed that I would come in from the road, put my guitar in the corner, and never refer to it. And one day I thought, it didn't used to be that way. I love to play music. And now I'm kind of disenchanted. So I went to rehearsal one night and told my bandmates that I was leaving. I was quitting. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, the Unitarians got wind of it and invited me to come and sing in the choir. They paid me to be a tenor in the choir at First Unitarian. That was a great experience. Mm-hmm. I met a whole lot of other expatriated Southern Baptists there. So things began to change. And but I didn't play for over a year. I was just really burnt out with it.
Mm-hmm. How old were you at this point, I guess?
Well, by the time I quit there, I was about early 30s, 32, 33. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was also starting to substitute teach a lot. And I got a full-time position with the school system to replace a teacher who was ill. I came in November to take over her kids, and it was a special ed class. Hmm. And I had 8 or 10 African-American boys, mm-hmm. and I loved them so much. Mm-hmm. But it was really, you know, this white dude with these black boys. I sometimes thought, that's kind of ironic.
Right.
But I learned a lot from them. Mm-hmm. They were streetwise. And right. They were labeled as LD, learning disabled.
Right.
But, you know, I'm just going to say this very candidly. Sometimes they would have trouble with math problems, but they could always do the math on what it costs for a pound of reefer and how much that would break down to and what the bag would be. Yeah. I mean, those guys are that. They're not really learning disabled. There's just mm-hmm. something else going on here.
Right.
But they were great kids, and I did that. And the woman, the teacher, died while I was there, and so I wound up staying the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And that was actually that was later on, after I had been subbing. That was 81 to 82. Mm-hmm. I came out of there and bought my house on Baxter Avenue that I'm still living in 32 years later.
Mm-hmm. And when did Homefront?
Homefront begin? Started actually when I moved into that new house, and I was playing by the, again in the bars solo, mm-hmm. mostly, just working up tunes and writing a little bit, not a whole lot, but some, and wanting to do more of that. And I was playing a lot, and bars are not the greatest place always to play music. It's kind of ironic. People are there drinking and, you know, what are the agendas there? Get drunk, get laid. That's the whole reason. Music is just something there for ambiance, I guess. Right. And you felt like the handmaiden to despair and, you know, life of getting high. And I was right along in there with him doing the same thing. So anyway, I started performing. And I had some friends that would come out to play. And we would always complain about not only to what it was like to perform in a club, but also for what it was like for people who came to hear you. And women were saying, every time I come out to hear you, somebody winds up hitting on me. And it's just, I'm tired of it, you know. So we started to dream of an alternative to that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the idea of radio at the beginning. But we got a group of people together and said, let's create something that's really special where people, it's a totally listening concert-type environment where people can come and it's a safe environment and we're not going to be playing for a lot of drunks. And it's all about the music. That was the dream. And one of those people that we got together was Marvin Maxwell. Ken Pyle was involved in that, those early meetings. This was 1983.
Okay.
And Ken Pyle was in that. And, man, he was great. Mike Schroeder was involved in it. A lot of folks that are legendary in Louisville. But Marvin Maxwell just kept saying, you need to make this a radio show. That's going to make it special. And, you know, I was thinking, well, yeah, sounds cool, but how do you even go about that, you know? Mm-hmm. So turned out Mike Schroeder knew Donovan, the guy that was then the station manager at WFPL in the library.
Right.
And then we were saying, where would we do this? And I said, boy, I know a great place. That old Presbyterian church that's no longer has any members, and it's just there, and right at the corner of 6th and Magnolia. I said, that's perfect, but we can't go there because I've already offered to do some concerts there to, as for part of a fundraising thing, and they turned me down. They didn't want to do that. And, you know, it was because they saw me as a, some sort of crazy derelict at the time. So, but Kenny Pyle's office was right next door. And he said, you've already talked to them and got turned down? I said, yeah. And he said, well, let me try. So all of a sudden, we had Mike Schroeder and Ken Pyle. Kenny called me back, and he said, you got it. You can use that facility. And that felt like a door opened. And of course, I had told all these people, I'm not doing this by myself. If I'm the only one that wants this, we're not doing it. So people started coming on board. Then we got the venue that was a really neat place. It was like a miniature Ryman Auditorium. It was wonderful. I know you were there some too in those days.
I remember when, I believe it was when I first started writing for the Louisville Times. I was a jazz critic for the Louisville Times. And you produced Eddie Cleanhead Vinson there.
That's great.
Jazz and blues.
And by the way, I need to get you, I went back and found, those were reel-to-reel tapes that we put the show on. I found those tapes.
Wow.
And I had them digitized, and I'll give you a copy
of
that show.
Oh, I'd love that.
Stan Moon.
Oh, yeah.
Was playing.
Right.
And I forget who else he had with him. But anyway, those are great shows.
Yeah, right. Now, since then, you've done all kinds of people, all kinds of musics, rather than...
Right. About the only kind of music that we've tended to sort of not include would be hip-hop. And I'm not against hip-hop, but the audience that we have is not really open to that. Mm-hmm. And heavy metal, punk. We haven't done much of those styles of music. Right. But other than that, we've covered the waterfront.
Right. Now, this was pre-Prairie Home Companion, I would presume.
Well, it was pretty much, Prairie Home was just barely getting going. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, it had been going on with Garrison Keillor for many years, but it was underground. I mean, no one knew about it. Mm-hmm. But it was starting to emerge as a national product right about that same time.
Yeah. Did you know about it?
Yes.
So
yes, I did.
So they gave you an idea this kind of thing would work, I guess.
It gave us a model to work on. You know, I didn't see myself as a Garrison Keillor, like a storyteller, raconteur. I wasn't that. And plus, I wanted it to really be a program that was more focused on the music than Prairie Home is. Prairie Home is a, I mean, you can't argue with that. Right. Garrison Keillor is who he is.
Right.
But Prairie Home is a lot of talking, mostly talking.
Right.
And I wanted it to be mostly music from the very beginning.
Yeah, locally, if you want to go back and what about Hayloft Hold Down? Did you ever
we
see
had
that?
Randy.
Did you?
And some of those members, we had them on the show well before Randy got sick. And, yeah, those were great days.
Randy Atcher, of course.
Randy Atcher, yeah. And I forget, I don't remember if Cactus Tom or Pete?
Cactus Tom Brooks.
Yeah. I don't know if he was there or not. I can't remember. But Randy Atcher was certainly there.
Tiny Toenail?
That's who was there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't think Cactus Tom was there. But
Bernie something on guitar. He had all characters in that band.
He did.
Yeah.
It was great.
Right.
But to just kind of loop back real quick, you know, Ken Pyle called and said, you got the venue. And then, like, a few days later, Mike Schroeder said, hey, I talked to Donovan, and we got a show. We got a slot on WFPL. And I was, to me, it was all green lights. So we began, that was in the fall of 83. We did our first show in March of 84.
Wow.
It was a bodacious move because all of us had been involved in production pretty much. A lot, not all of us, but a lot of us. Ken Pyle certainly had been doing stuff. And he was also, that was right at the beginning of Ken's place, the Rudyard Kipling.
Right.
So his involvement was a little bit less because he was putting a lot of energy into getting the Rudyard going. But without ever having done a show together, this group of people, we went on the air live.
Wow.
Now, I think I look back on it now, I would not do that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, what's wrong with you? I might say I'm going to work up to that,
right.
But not day one, first show you've ever produced with this group of people.
Right.
And you're going on live. We didn't know anything about radio or mm-hmm. all the details. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we just did what we do. And it began to grow. And I owe a debt of gratitude to Dan Gettleman, who was working at WFPL. And he was a young man, but he was pretty sharp. And he knew a lot about radio production, still mm-hmm. does. Mm-hmm. And he was a great mentor for us. Mm-hmm. You know, he met with us and said, man, you guys got to clean this up. You know, this is, there's a lot you need to learn. Mm-hmm. And he really helped us. Mm-hmm. And I owe him a tip of the hat.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you like to play a song or two?
Oh, I can play the theme song for the radio show.
Okay, why don't we do that?
Okay. Okay, this song is a song I wrote with the intent that it would be a theme song for the radio show. But I only used the first verse of it. And after that, I always warn people that after following that first verse, which seems relatively upbeat and okay, it takes a sharp turn into darkness after that. So, there's a song that I sing to the lines on the highway, to the faces I have seen in the rambling that is my way. Singing in time with a band on the radio, in the rhythm and the rhyme, what I already know. Well, I don't understand all the things I do. I give the best away, leave the rest for you. What can it mean? True love's turned to ashes, like shadows in my dreams, when the lightning flashes. Your way and mine once were entwined. We walked this pathway together, in the broken ties that bind, in the wind blowing blind. I feel a change in the weather. Lovers we were in the dawn of the morning, whispered words of passion, spoke not a warning. Deep in the night, in the dark of the garden, hearts that were broken, starting to harden. There's a song that I sing to the lines on the highway, to the faces I have seen in the rambling that is my way. Singing in time with the band on the radio, in the rhythm and the rhyme, what I already know.
Wow, boy, that was terrific.
Thanks, Danny.
Full of power.
Your voice really takes over the room. Yeah. And your spirit also.
Thanks.
You say that song was about your marriage at one time?
Well, it was about the coming apart and end of my marriage, my first marriage. I always say that was like 75% my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little bit out of control. I was a whole lot out of control. And screwed the whole thing up. Fortunately, things from that have emerged in about the best way they possibly could. I'm very close to my first wife, and she later on, married my best friend. We were buddies in seminary together and really did a lot of work together, worked on projects together. We were very close. We were in undergraduate school together. I knew him longer than I knew her. And it was a little awkward, for your ex-wife to marry your close friend. And he and I talked about it. But it really came to me that if my boys were going to have a stepfather, he's about the best choice I could come up with.
And you have a son that is a terrific blues musician.
I came from a second marriage, Will.
I see.
Will. Actually, all my boys are very musical.
I'd only seen him perform. Saw him at Homefront, I guess, was last year or something like that.
Yes,
and boy,
last April.
It was just,
Harry Pickens was on that show, too.
Wow, yeah.
And he and Harry played. The thing that he stayed right up with Harry, but they played an old T-Bone Walker song together.
So Harry took a little bit of his blues hat.
That show, Harry said, I don't want to do my regular thing. I want to get into some funk and all kinds of things and blues. And so Will came on and did a number with him, and it was just mind-blowing. It was really excellent. And Will is I'm very proud of him. He's following a musical career. With all of that entails, he's struggling. He's poor. And he just completed his first CD project called Traveling Man. He wrote all the material, did all the engineering, and produced it. It's a good product.
Is he a traveling musician mainly?
Is he what?
A traveling musician mainly? He travels?
He's mostly Texas-based, but he knows that he needs to get on the road. And, of course, he comes back and forth. He drives straight through from San Antonio to Louisville. It's 1,000 miles. I'm like, here's $75. Get a room and get some rest. It's dangerous. I can't. Occasionally I win, but most of the time he's determined, and he drives himself with no brakes for like 16 hours. I'm like, dude, even truckers don't do that. But anyway, he is a wonderful man. I'm deeply moved by his work, his passion. That is, I think, probably the beginning, the start and the end of Will, because he said to me one time, if you don't have any soul, just get off the stage. What a brash young man, but he's right.
Right.
That's really what it's all about. Right. I don't care what style of music is. And this is what I call balls to the wall rock and roll. I mean, he's playing rock and roll. He's got one powerful blues tune that makes me cry still every time I hear it. It's called Help Me With My Mind. It's a beautiful song. I'll give you a record, one of his records.
Sure. Now, all your children are musical, you say?
That's right. The oldest, my oldest was he was in undergraduate school as a music major, but he always loved computers. He called me one day. He was out in Washington State. And he said, I've been thinking about it. I think I'm going to kind of have music as a hobby and go ahead and change my major to computer science. And there was a little pause there. I said, so are you afraid I'm going to be upset about that? He said, well, no, I just want to tell you. I said, well, actually, it's a relief because I know how hard it is to do anything with a music degree, so... Now he works. He's a senior project manager for a startup company, and he's doing very well. Mm-hmm. So that's good.
So
and
now,
Jeff, the other one, my son that's 39, he's in Denmark. He's not really playing a lot, but he is a wonderful guitar player. And he was in the U of L School of Music for a couple of semesters, but he impressed everybody there with his guitar playing, his stylings. But it's the young one that's kind of staked that out as a major career objective.
So now, Homefront moved, and you're in over there at Clifton Center now.
That's right. We were in a couple of places. We did shows. There was actually two iterations of Homefront, from 1984 to 94, and then we stopped. And we did, back in those days, we were at the church there on 6th and Magnolia. Then we did some shows at Bellarmine and Fraser Hall. Then, no, the Wyatt Auditorium there. Isn't that what it is? Anyway, whatever, at Bellarmine. And then we also kind of settled into First Unitarian Church. And then I was, in 1994, I was really wanting to do some other stuff. I wanted to really get involved in environmental education and in a lot of more activism. So we quit. We stopped doing Homefront. And then along the way, I got involved with the, I was working for the school district then. I got involved with the Kentucky Arts Council, which got me out into the state a lot more. And went on retreats, artist retreats down in by Fallbush, Kentucky, at the U of K facility that's down there, a really wonderful place. We'd be there together for 3 or 4 days, and I heard all these artists performing. And I was sitting there, we had a little coffee house thing going, and I thought, man, this needs to be on the radio. This would be good. This is really great stuff. So I got this idea back in the late 90s, started working on it, and then we got the Kentucky Theater. We were there for a while at 4th and York, 4th and
yes,
on 4th Street, just north of Broadway, the old Kentucky Theater. And George, the owner of the building, gave us permission to use it for free, but we had to do all the renovation, and it was really in bad shape. It had been just sitting there for a couple of decades, but we got a lot of volunteers and a lot of elbow grease and turned it around, and we started recording shows in 2001 and went back on the air on WFPK at that time in 2002. June of 2002, we started back on the air. We've been on continuously since then. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful for support from WFPK and the vision that they have for supporting local music. We also have a very more of a narrow focus, because our focus is on local and regional. And that, by region, for me, I mean kind of a line connecting Indianapolis and Dayton, nothing further north than that, and then the whole east and west breadth of Kentucky, all the way down to Knoxville, Nashville. If you drew a line there, that sort of rectangular box is where we draw our talent from. And I try to keep my ear to the ground. There's an incredible, as you will, the music in Louisville and Jefferson County and southern Indiana alone is overwhelming.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right.
The number of great acts that are out there.
Right.
Somebody said to me one time, so you have this local and regional focus, aren't you afraid you'll run out of acts? And I said, well, I've been doing it really for 22 years. I don't see the bottom of the barrel.
That's why the people that I've had on in the past on this show, on the Fringe program here, is like Gil Holland, who is so much
What a
involved.
Wonderful thing he brought to this community.
Mm-hmm.
He's bringing to this community.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sonoblast. And
right.
He's a very visionary guy.
And he recognizes, we were talking about, well, he's now in Portland. And he was talking about driving through Portland, and one of his first trips down there, he got to thinking, looking around, he said, well, this looks like New Orleans down here. And it does. You know, there's certain sections of it. You know,
absolutely.
That,
and it has the histories of those
right.
two areas.
The shotgun houses, the ambience.
The whole bit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I had thought of that before, but and actually, ironically, I've never been to New Orleans, so
oh,
what a crazy thing. I got to get down there.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's about time.
Right.
But well, I think Gil is exactly right.
I want to thank you, John Gage, for joining me.
Thank you.
Here on Louisville Arts and Entertainment on the Fringe. And do you have anything coming up? that you'd like to talk about before we sign off?
I don't know when this will air, but we do have
soon.
We have a show coming up this coming Saturday, the 14th of December, that features two new artists that are both on the Sonoblast label.
Mm.
Kyle James Hauser, a wonderful performer, a Berklee School graduate in songwriting, has a degree in songwriting. He's a very talented young man. And then another group called Beady, B-E-A-D-Y. And we only have two people from that band, but they'll be performing on the show. They're young people with folk roots, acknowledging their folk roots. And then also on that show, we have some veteran folk players, Alan Rohde, who's folk and country.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And a successful Nashville writer.
Right.
And then Sparky and Rhonda Rucker. You probably know them, too. Mm-hmm. Sparky Rucker is a folklorist as well as a great musician.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, Rhonda, plays, four or five different instruments, keyboards, banjo, and guitar. And they're going to be on. Their music is what I would call traditional folk music. Mm-hmm. And is an educational experience just to be in a concert where they're playing. So that's mm-hmm. coming up on the 14th. And we do feature some storytelling now, and we have Colonel Bob Thompson mm-hmm. on to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's coming up on the 14th. And also, people have to look for it, but Will, my youngest son, is coming to town. He has a New Year's Eve gig in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to get a room in Houston and get up the next day and drive to Louisville. So he'll be in Louisville on right. He'll be in Louisville probably sometime the wee hours of January 2nd, and I've already got us booked. Probably, I think we're going to be at the Rudyard Kipling on January 3rd. Prior to that, too, I have my old horn player, Bruce Cromer, who's mm-hmm. coming to town. December 27th, we'll be at the Rudyard.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that are coming up. I'm really excited about that because, obviously, being able to play with my son, and it'll be an acoustic show, and she's usually doing electric, but that's what we'll have on tap at the Rudyard, January 3rd. And then Bruce will be playing clarinet and saxophone with me, just the two of us. We had a duo together. We played together off and on for 25 years.
Wow. Yeah.
That's the exciting thing for me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, John Gage, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Danny.